trustee Hagel presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Morning, everybody. We're very happy to be here in Toledo. This morning we have the case of Noah versus McDonald. The docket number is 150334. Who will speak for Mr. Noah?
Judge Hagel, honors, and please support this shock deploys.
Yeah, let me just get the other counsel to introduce themselves. Jacques
Duployes.
Duployes?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And for the secretary?
Good morning, Your Honor. Sarah Fusina, on behalf of the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. With me is Deputy Chief Counsel Nicole Cottle.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Duployes? I see that you want to reserve 10 minutes, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. You may begin.
Your Honor, the court on Monday added the issue of due process to this particular case. And in reviewing that specific issue, which I'll start with, is that I believe one of the early cases the court ruled on was Morris v. Winsky. One that at 260, 1991, specifically because it deals with the statute which we believe is operative, which is 38 CFR section 3.158. So that was the regulation that the court was reviewing in that case. And specifically towards the end, the court noted that the appellant had raised a due process clause argument regarding that he was never notified about the 1 year. And obviously the court went on what is interesting is that it noted that they didn't have to tell anything about the 1 year because it fulfilled the due process. Specifically, they stated the appellant was on notice of what was expected of him and he failed to respond. This is not a case in which the VA refused to consider entitlement, but an instance in which a claimant failed to perfect a right claim. So the court at that point felt that because the veteran had been notified what he needed to do, that the VA had fulfilled the due process. This case is very unique in that the veteran was told a different time in which to submit the evidence.
Counselor, can you give me that citation again, please?
For Morris?
Yes.
It is 1 Fed App 260, 1991. And part of the reason that I bring that up on my due process argument is because in Jernigan, which I had cited, Nishinsiki, decided in 2012, the court found that Morris was dispositive to the argument that the veteran in that case had argued that the notice was didn't really explain what they need to do. Basically, the court was relying upon Morris to say, well, there's this general idea of you come to an agency, ignorance of the law is not an excuse. But more importantly, he concluded by saying that in Jernigan, the veteran had not, or the appellant had not, given any indication that they relied upon any defective information to their detriment, which goes back to the equitable tolling, which is that it's a burden on the appellant to show that, one, if they show that it's a defective notice, that they relied upon it. And in this case, it's pretty, at least we submit that the record shows that the appellant relied upon it and just stopped trying to get the information he needed. In looking at the due process, in the way that I was looking at the cases, it seemed to be that the equitable tolling is really the remedy for a due process violation if the court finds that.
I want to make sure that we all have the same understanding of the operative facts here. your client, Mr. Noah, originally filed a claim for what amounted to post-traumatic stress disorder in the 80s, correct?
1981, yes, sir.
Right. And the VA gave him a notice and said, look, we need some more information. We need to know what, I'll do my best here to quit that humming. He said, the VA says, okay, look, we need some more information. We know your units in Vietnam. We want to know what your stressors were and so forth. And then, and it says, and oh, by the way, if you got any private medical records, send them to us, correct? And they said, we need this in 60 days. Send it to us in 30 days, if you don't, but if we don't get it in 60 days, you're out of here. We'll consider your claim withdrawn. But the problem was what? What was the problem?
That the regulation 33.158 specifically says, what's interesting about this regulation, there's no timetable for the VA. If you look at any point they can send this letter, and if the veteran doesn't respond within 1 year, the veteran doesn't have to be told they have 1 year, but if they don't respond, then it's considered abandoned, and the VA never adjudicates that claim. It's gone.
And but the point is, let me get back to the sort of setting the stage. The point is that the regulation gives the individual 1 year to file this additional, any additional information the individual wants to file.
Correct.
Before the claim is dismissed. Now, am I correct there? Is that your, now with us all understanding, I want to make sure we all understand where we are here. And so in this case, the individual got a letter that said, Mr. Noah got a letter that says, you've got to give us your stuff within 60 days or we're going to dismiss the claim.
It specifically says, we will consider your claim withdrawn.
That's correct, yeah.
And they never acted on it. I think what I misunderstood, Your Honor, was that the significance in this case is he eventually reapplied in 2007. And when he was awarded benefits after development, they picked the effective date of 2007 specifically because 38 CFR 3.158 says, hey, if we consider your claim abandoned, the only date can be when you reapply. And so it's the operation of this regulation that Mr. Noah is seeking some sort of relief, because the uniqueness of his case is that both he and his wife indicated they moved from Alaska down to California for the sole purpose of trying to get help for his post-traumatic stress disorder, applied for benefits, made efforts to get evidence necessary, and when he realized he couldn't, he just said, okay, I'm done, and moved back to Alaska.
I'd like to first start with your arguments regarding equitable tolling and then later talk about due process. You assert that equitable tolling would be appropriate in this case, and you rely on a 2-VETAP case of this court called Smith, where they considered equitable tolling but found that the facts didn't support its application. But didn't the Federal Circuit in Andrews recently say that equitable tolling was not appropriate in a context like this where you're seeking an earlier effective date?
Well, I guess the argument would be that when I was looking at the statute, it was a situation where when you look at equitable estoppel, which the board had said, look, we can't do that. The idea is that everyone agrees that the information given by the Veterans Administration was incorrect.
Right.
And the facts in this case are that the veteran relied on that to his detriment, did not continue, had 10 more months in which he could have gotten the information and submitted that what we're seeking is an earlier effective date, not because it should go automatically back to 1981. It is more that this particular regulation should not be used against the veteran for the board going and reviewing if there's any possible earlier effective date, because their reliance is upon this particular regulation.
is this regulation or the statute that it's based upon a statute of limitations?
Yes, because much like an accident where you have no idea when that accident occurs, you're given a time limit in which to bring a suit. In this situation, there's nothing to indicate when the Veterans Administration will send that letter. When it sends that letter, that starts the 1 year, and so therefore it's much like the statute of limitations because you have no idea when it's going to arise, and once it arrives, that 1 year begins.
In equitable tolling under Irwin, you would need to show that Mr. Noah acted diligently to preserve his rights. If we are to look at assessing a period of diligence, do we look at the 60 days following the misleading notice? Do we look at the year that he actually had under the regulation? Or do we look at the entire time period until he returned to VA and filed his claim for PTSD in the 2000s?
I would say it's the 60-day time period that he was given, because under Irwin's way, what I was reading was the court was looking at, was making the same look. If you look at the actions of this veteran, in that case, they're saying, had he been sent the correct notification that he could apply for this benefit, there's every reason to conclude he would have followed up, which is why there has to be somewhat of a finding that had he been, had he been given that information, that he would have followed up. And what we're saying is, in this particular case, the evidence that we submitted showed that Mr. Noah is making every effort possible during the 60-day time period and believed that his case was going to be withdrawn if he couldn't. And so he relied upon that notice.
Go ahead, please.
Well, Counselor, could you raise the concept of equitable tolling at the board level? I understand you represented the appellant at the board level. Did you raise that concept to the board?
I don't think I used the exact term at the hearing, equitable tolling. What I was arguing was the sort of the facts, which was that this particular veteran relied upon a defective notice. And in the board's decision, they made it clear. They said, yes, that was a misleading notice.
My point is, if you didn't raise it below, this is a court of appeals. So you're asking us to review it for the first time without having given the board the opportunity to review the concept as applied to this case.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would have to say that I did not use the I did not use the term equitable tolling. I argued with the board that they should not use that regulation against the veteran based upon the facts of the case. But no, I did not use the term.
And are you familiar with the Bowles case, Bowles versus Russell?
No, Your Honor.
That's a 2007 Supreme Court of the United States case that dealt with a capital case that came out of the Sixth Circuit there, where the defendant was given wrong information by the judge, and the Supreme Court said that's the way it is, and gave him no relief. In light of that case, I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts might be.
Well. Again, what I keep coming back to is the idea, which is this is a time element. One of the reasons I think it's clear equitable estoppel doesn't apply because Mr. Noah is not automatically entitled to get benefits back to 1981. What we're dealing with is this particular statute of regulations stating quite clearly that. If it applies, then he can only go to when he reapplies at some later date after the 1 year. So this is more of a time limit as opposed to, as the case had talked about, why equitable estoppel doesn't work, is that if you're going against the government and trying to get monetary benefits, that's where the Supreme Court has made clear that equitable estoppel doesn't apply. I guess I don't have much of an answer in a criminal case where someone's relying upon information from a judge or from the government and then trying to say, well, I relied upon that, and so it shouldn't be used against me.
And you're aware that Congress gave the Secretary the authority under 38 U.S.C. 503A to provide equitable relief in circumstances similar to those that you allege in this case?
And I believe that's a separate procedure that's going directly to the Secretary.
Correct.
And in my research, I saw nothing that said that that was the sole avenue for getting any equitable relief from the Veterans Administration. Quite frankly, I think would be a negligence if I did not pursue going through the board to this court. In candor to the court, if this may be a case where it's made clear to people that if you are seeking equity, you need to go directly to the Secretary. But the problem I see there is I don't see any judicial relief under that path as far as that if there's any review if the veteran is denied equitable relief.
Thank you.
In order for you to prevail for equitable tolling, there are certain elements that you would have to show. Can you talk about those elements for a minute and how you believe the evidence has satisfied those elements?
Well, I believe the first is that there has to be the defective notice. In other words, or something in this particular situation where the first element is that there is some representation that someone relies upon. And then the second one is it's to their detriment. And so in this particular case, I think the first two are the elements that I believe the court looks at.
When I look at it and analyze it, I would phrase it perhaps a little differently. And in my view, there are three elements: would be an extraordinary circumstance, which you might say is the misleading notice. And then there's a concept of due diligence. And then there's an issue of causation, which did these things in fact cause the injury that you claim that was caused. So could you talk a little bit about the due diligence aspect of this case? In other words, what was it that Mr. Noah did during this over 10-year period to attempt to get the benefits for PTSD?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What did he do, Mr. Noah, do during this period to show due diligence in his attempt to get disability benefits for PTSD? Because I haven't seen anything in the record, except for there are a few items which I'm sure you might address, that shows over this entire time period where he did anything beyond going to a few medical clinics. And he certainly didn't give the VA any information about what units he was in Vietnam, what stressors he faced, whether he had any private medical records and so forth. So can you address that due diligence aspect, please?
And I would again go back to that I believe it's during the 60-day time period, because once he decided that he could not comply and his case was going to be withdrawn, after that time period, he believed and the VA believed that his case had been withdrawn. And when he reapplied and was granted the benefits, that's when it was, that's when he's having to look at this, and that's one of the reasons why we submitted a retrospective examination by a psychologist to say, like, had he seen somebody, there was evidence from his statements and from his spouse that he would have been diagnosed with PTSD, and unfortunately he went back to Alaska to be away from people so that he didn't seek any. So again, Your Honor, I would just say that my focus was on the 60 days for two reasons. One is that's where we had evidence that he made efforts to try to comply, and he relied upon that 60 days and said, well, I'm done. The second thing is that just as I cited in Ingram, these cases can linger for years. And once the court looks at a situation where, had Mr. Noah never been sent that original letter, they would have had to look back at 1981 and said, well, that claim's been pending all these times. That doesn't mean it automatically wins, just means they're looking at the entire time period. And so the uniqueness of veterans law is that cases can be lingering for a number of years, and there can be significant issues involved with that. And basically, in Mr. Snow's case, I would note that because there was no decision, doesn't have the benefit of perhaps of having his case reopened and getting an earlier effective date based upon new material evidence or arguing a CUE or clear and unmistakable error because there was no previous decision.
We have one more.
Wait,
question.
Don't sit down. wanted to talk about your due process argument now that you did raise before the board. You argued that there was constitutionally infirm notice, and also you mentioned it in your supplemental briefing. So the Supreme Court has looked at Social Security cases, and I don't know about the Supreme Court, but a lot of circuit courts have looked at Social Security cases where appellants were told, you can come back and file at any time, but there was actually a four-year deadline, and then they were prevented from being able to come back into the system. And that notice was found to be constitutionally infirm because they were told a period that was longer than they had to actually come back. Your client was told a shorter period. So does that rise to the same level of a constitutional defect? And if so, why?
It's because the veteran filed his claim, and then he is told, the ball's in your court. You have to do something now, and you have to do it within 60 days. And so when he is given incorrect information, he's not able to...
So your argument is any kind of incorrect information that he relied upon would be sufficient to make the notice inadequate for due process.
I wouldn't say any defective notice, but in this situation, it's a clearly defective in regards to the timeline for him to take the action. Going back to Morrison, one of the first cases was the due process was found to have been that the VA told the veteran, you need to get us this information. Didn't have to tell him when, and veteran didn't, and they felt that, this veteran was informed what he needed to do. Didn't have to tell him when the time limit was, and he never did anything. This is almost the exact opposite, where the veteran is told the incorrect time, and we believe the record shows that he was making efforts to try to comply, and so therefore, it's. I don't know if there's degrees of defectiveness, but certainly in this situation, it is defective as to a time limit that will become significant under that particular statute and regulation because it will affect him later on at some point in the future should he reapply.
Okay, thank you very much.
Please the court, your honors. Equitable tolling is not applicable to 38 U.S.C. 3003A or VA's regulations 38 CFR 3.158 and 3.109 for the following three reasons. First, your honors, the scope of equitable tolling should not be broadened, as this court has only applied it in limited circumstances, specifically in aid of its own jurisdiction, which is not at issue here today. Second, your honors, both the Federal Circuit and this court have held that equitable tolling is not applicable to effective dates. 3003A and VA's regulations here govern not only the submission of evidence, but also the date on which benefits may begin to be paid, making them effective date provisions which cannot be equitably tolled. And third, Your Honors, the plain language of the statute clearly indicates that Congress did not intend for equitable tolling to be applicable because there is an explicit prohibition against payment. First, Your Honors, this court has held that the 120 days in which to file a notice of appeal to this court can be equitably tolled. However, once again, that is a jurisdictional statute, not a claims processing statute as we have before us today. And indeed, this court has recognized in Edwards that there is no identified authority empowering this court to grant equitable relief to extend a deadline other than that which permits this court to obtain jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has advocated for equitable tolling to be applied sparingly.
Well, let me talk about Edwards a little bit. Why is that? How does that support your position?
Your Honors, we believe it supports our position in two ways. And this first then goes to, if I may get into a little bit, my second point, which is that equitable tolling is limited to tolling or suspending the running of a time limitation that would bar future claims, so a statute of limitations, which is not an issue here. So Edwards does address both components of the submission of evidence as well as effective dates, which are contained in the statute and regulations we are addressing today. So first, with effective dates, it has been well held by the Federal Circuit and this court in Andrews and Edwards that effective dates are not statutes of limitations, and therefore they cannot be equitably tolled because they only govern the date on which benefits may begin to be paid, not whether one is entitled to them at all.
Talk to me a little bit about the aspects of the notice that was given in Edwards without the talking about the particular parts that you're pulling out of the case. So put this in factual context, because here the essence is of this argument, as I understand it, is not only was the note, not only did they give defective notice, but the notice they gave was misleading. So I don't see any of those facts appearing in Edwards. Matter of fact, you know, obviously, Edwards is the law, but I don't see the facts at all measuring up with the facts that we see here, where there is clearly false information given to the appellant.
Your Honors, well, we have conceded that the 1982 letter contained some misleading information.
Some misleading information? What do you mean by some?
Insofar as informing appellant of the time limitation in which that he needed to reply.
You concede that the letter said, hey, you've only got 60 days and your claim is gone if you don't give us anything, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. We concede that the notice letter contains that information, and that, yes, you are right that the exact facts are not the exact same as those in Edwards. However, what we're arguing here is that the legal principles expressed in Edwards do apply.
But if the facts aren't the same, I mean, the key facts aren't the same, how can this case support your position? I mean, the key facts in Edwards that would put it in the context of this case.
Your Honor, respectfully, we do still believe that Edwards supports our position because it stands for the legal principle of when equitable tolling can be applicable. And it is our position that it is only applicable when there is a statute of limitations involved. And in this case, we do not have a statute of limitations. So the sole remedy that appellant is arguing for here, equitable tolling, is legally inapplicable. And if I may go to the second part of the statute, which is the submission of evidence, Edwards also addressed that component, holding that that is also not a statute of limitations. So equitable tolling could not be used in order to extend a deadline merely in order to afford an earlier effective date, which is exactly what is being asked for in this case.
But why couldn't there be? I'm having a hard time understanding that argument when, similar to other cases that deal in other contexts, if there are many reasons why time can be extended. For example, if an individual files a notice of disagreement in a case, and the VA fails to give the individual a statement of the case, that case is still open and available to adjudication. And that's not an issue of statute of limitations. And why couldn't that same principle be applied here? In that the case would just remain open. In other words, the time to file the evidence or produce the evidence would be tolled. Because isn't the ability to provide evidence a regulatory right of Mr. Noah? Just as a statement of the case is?
Yes, Your Honor, but we would point out a important distinction there in which in your notice of disagreement hypothetical, the secretary would have then failed to satisfy an express regulatory requirement to send a statement of the case. However, here under both the statute and the regulations, the requirement is for the secretary to give notice or to request the evidence, which we would posit that the 1982 letter satisfies, that the 82 letter informs appellant of the evidence that VA needs, which in this case included the combat and stressor information, as well as asking him, do you have any medical information? If so, either submit it or we can help you obtain it if you authorize us to. So we would argue then the ball essentially shifts to appellant's court to reply, and that the purpose of such statutes is to encourage participation by the veteran in the adjudication of their claims.
What if VA had also told him and he needs to submit $1 million or something ridiculous like that? I don't see how that would fulfill the purpose of the notice by providing so obviously misleading information that differs from the statute or the regulation. And also getting to the point of VA is not required to submit this information, 3.109 was amended a few years subsequent to Mr. Noah's case to require VA to provide the explicit time period within which a veteran is supposed to submit or a claimant is supposed to submit that information. And it's in the notice of rulemaking, it says if claimants or beneficiaries are not furnished notice of the time limits within which they are required to act, it is unreasonable to penalize them for failing to act within those limits. Failure to notify a claimant was deemed, or to give wrong information was deemed to be the same as giving them no information. And the new regulation went on to provide opportunities to ask for extensions of time. So with the department conducting a 180-degree shift in its view of what is owed to the veteran, because that is what is required for good notice, how can we, in this case, find that there was sufficient notice when he was told the wrong information?
Well, first, respectfully, Your Honor, the court would need to apply the laws that were in application at the time of appellant's claim. So the version of 3.109 that was in application in 1982, which did not contain that provision. And actually, Your Honor, if I'm looking at the current version, it also doesn't contain that requirement anymore. The only requirement is for VA to notify appellant of the evidence that is necessary to complete or substantiate, because there was no difference at the time, their application, and that then the appellant has 1 year. And actually, at the time, Your Honor, 3.109B contained information stating that even if appellant is not notified of the time limitation in which to submit evidence, that would not extend that time period. But what we have, Your Honor, is no communication whatsoever from appellant, whether that's within the 60 days, within the year, or anything for 25 years until he filed a brand new claim for PTSD in December of 2007.
Would it have mattered if he walked back into the VA a year and a day subsequent to VA sending out the misleading notice?
Well, Your Honor, that somewhat goes back to the legal environment that VA operates in that there is no statute of limitations on the claiming of a service connection disability benefit. So appellant was free at any time to file a new claim. So had he come to VA in your hypothetical a year and a day afterwards, he could have filed a new claim.
But that would have been the effective date then, that 1 year and 1 day later. It would not relate back, would it?
It would not relate back because by statute it is 1 year from the date of notification. However, we emphasize again, we have no communication whatsoever from appellant, and we emphasize that the 1982 letter did ask him for evidence that he has since conceded were within his lay capabilities to provide. Nonetheless, we have no communication from him either providing that lay evidence or even expressing that he needed more time to gather the medical evidence that he wished to gather or that he was confused and needed clarification. We simply have no communication. Appellant withdrew himself from the process.
Counselor, if I may inquire, what if the court should hold that the one-year period never began to run because the notice was defective?
In that scenario, Your Honor, we would emphasize again that would not be an application of equitable tolling because that is legally inapplicable. If the court finds that it cannot affirm the board's decision, the scenario, Your Honor, that you have painted would perhaps be more akin to a waiver scenario, but the sole remedy that appellant has argued for here is equitable tolling, and so we are here today to emphasize that that equitable doctrine is legally inapplicable because there is no statute of limitations and because appellant was free at any time to file a new claim. And nonetheless, we once again would also direct this court's attention to the facts of the case, which do demonstrate that appellant had absolutely no communication whatsoever with VA, despite having evidence within his own power to provide. And we simply have no communication for 25 years until he files a new claim in December 2007.
Well, that's not exactly accurate, is it? Didn't he have a knee claim in 1990, which would have been 8 years, I think, after this all went down?
Yes, Your Honor. My apologies if I can clarify. I was saying that there was no communication with regards to his PTSD claim for 25 years. And actually, that intervening claim, we believe, supports our position in that he also didn't mention his PTSD when he filed that left knee claim. And in that left knee claim, VA did send him notice requesting evidence, and appellant responded promptly there within 1 month asking VA to help him get a medical examination. So that to us demonstrates that appellant had some knowledge of how to communicate with VA, but that he affirmatively and consciously chose not to in 1982.
Thank you.
I'd like to turn to the due process issue. Do you assert that this notice satisfies constitutional scrutiny?
We would argue, Your Honor, that the due process requirements here would be notice and the opportunity to be heard, and that the 1982 letter was reasonably calculated to inform appellant of the evidence that was required to be submitted, and that insofar as there was a misstatement of the time limitation, we don't find that to be so infirm as to violate the Constitution, because appellant was still placed on notice that he needed to participate in the process and submit evidence. He was given an opportunity to do so, but he consciously chose to remove himself from the process.
What if he was told a time period that was ridiculously small, like 2 days? Would that make a difference?
Respectfully, we would posit it does not, because the requirement ultimately is that he be given notice of what actions he needs to take.
But if it's a notice and an opportunity to be heard, if he cannot comply with the information that he's notified of in order to be heard, it seems that the time period being less than what he should have been provided by statute would be significant enough to be considered misleading in a constitutionally infirm way.
Perhaps the scenario might be different with 2 days, but we would posit that within the 60 days, appellant had the opportunity to provide the evidence that was within his lay capabilities to provide, and that was his opportunity to be heard. Had he communicated at all with VA by providing that lay evidence, or even by asking VA for assistance or more time, it would have been VA's typical procedures to first hold his claim open, because the purpose of the statute of regulations is to encourage participation, and second, to provide assistance if appellant so sought.
But the notice said if you can't provide this and this within 60 days, your claim will be withdrawn. It didn't say provide us one and we'll give you more time.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we read the notice as simply saying please reply, and there's no requirement that, and there's certainly no requirement in the regulation that he provide every single piece of evidence that's being requested, but that he continue to participate in the process and to assist VA in adjudicating his claim. And in this scenario, that would be with some of that lay evidence that was within his capabilities to provide.
Well, indulge me, and let's assume that the notice is constitutionally infirm. The inquiry doesn't stop there. We then have to look as to whether the veteran had detrimental reliance. My reading of the case law is that it's a different inquiry than it would be under equitable tolling, where we would have to look at diligence for whatever period is the appropriate period. If we look at detrimental reliance, could you talk to me as to whether you agree that the veteran relied on the misleading notice?
So, Your Honor, appellant has stated for the first time nearly 30 years after the fact that he relied on that notice and ceased trying to get medical evidence. However, we would argue that he has not shown that even if he believed he only had a 60-day time period, that that had any connection with his conscious failure to initiate any form of communication with VA at all, and that would include the lay evidence that we have been talking about, as well as any form of communication if he had asked VA for assistance or for clarification. So we do not believe that he has satisfied that. And Your Honor, if I may make another point, appellant is arguing for due process solely as another avenue to achieve equitable tolling. So we would again emphasize that equitable tolling is legally inapplicable. And Judge Shulman, the cases that you have mentioned, so the Social Security Administration cases, we find those to be distinguishable from our case because those do involve statutes of limitations, that after that four-year period passes, a claimant is barred from bringing a future claim. But we emphasize again, there is no barring here. Appellant is free to file a new claim at any time.
Well, only if he can submit new material evidence, which has been a bar to a significant number of veterans. So
indeed, that's a new claim, correct?
Respectfully,
not the same claim.
Respectfully, Your Honor, yeah, it would be a new claim, so there's no new and material evidence requirement because he's not trying to reopen a claim because his claim has been deemed
abandoned.
Yes.
I don't know that VA necessarily treated it that way when he actually came back 2,000 years, or in 2007 or whatever it was. I think they did say something about reopening, but
perhaps they used the wrong term, but they did treat that as a new claim. He also, once again, in December 2007, simply, that was a new claim, and he made no reference whatsoever to his 1981 claim. So VA did properly choose the effective date as the, per VA's regulations and the statute, that it has to be the later of the date that the claim was filed or the date entitlement arose.
So if I can make sure I understand the VA's position here, it is that number one, the Secretary prevails because this isn't dealing with a statute of limitations, and the only time that equitable tolling can apply is when there's a statute of limitations, correct? And number two, that even if the court were to believe that that's not correct, then the appellant fails on the second element of equitable tolling in that Mr. Noah did not exhibit due diligence in pursuing his relief to substantiate his claim, correct?
Yes, sir.
Are there any other grounds that you, that Secretary believes that support his case?
Your Honor, those are our two main points in that, to reiterate what you've said, that equitable tolling is legally inapplicable, and even if this court finds that it should consider equitable tolling, that the due diligence element has not been met. And Your Honor, the equitable relief that appellant is seeking here is available solely at the discretion of the Secretary, as was pointed out by Judge Lance under 38 U.S.C. 503. But that does necessitate a direct application to the Secretary, which has not been made in this case.
Counselor, can you give me your views on how the case of PVA versus Secretary of Veterans Affairs, I'm sure you're familiar with that case, what impact, if any, that has on this particular case?
Your Honor, if I could just clarify your question and get a better sense of where you're coming from, sure. Could you tell me a little bit more about what component of that case?
Well, it held the regulation invalid, which mischaracterized the time frame that the veteran had. And I believe it dealt with this specific regulation, or one very similar to it.
Yes,
and
Your
basically
Honor.
Basically, the Federal Circuit said it's misleading, and so therefore it's not adequate.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm just trying to refamiliarize myself with the case, but I do believe that is solely in the context of the regulation and how that regulation was written at the time and whether that meant that VA could adjudicate a claim, I believe it was within 30 days, without receiving evidence from appellant. But we would argue that that scenario is not applicable here. We're not talking about whether or not a regulation was misleading. We have conceded that the letter does misrepresent the time limitation, but as stated, the sole remedy that appellant is seeking here is simply legally inapplicable, and even if it was not, there is no diligence demonstrated here that would warrant the application of equitable tolling.
Thank
you very
much.
If there are no further questions, Your Honors, the Secretary respectfully requests that this court affirm the board's November 28, 2014 decision and find that equitable tolling is inapplicable to the statute and regulations at issue today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Members, I would note that obviously the system, even today at the administrative level, is a non-adversarial system. And the difficulty is with Mr. Noah is that in 1990, about 8 years later, he did apply for benefits again. And that's at the record 724. And when you look at it, he specifically marked the box. Number 8, have you ever filed a claim for compensation? He was talking about the officer compensation. I misunderstood. I thought he was marking the box and said he'd ever applied for VA benefits. He marked the box now. But with that in mind, the other thing is that the 1982 letter, which is at 735, the very last paragraph is one paragraph, and it starts with, we must have post-service medical evidence to support your claim. Can you obtain medical records for us of your treatment since service? Or, if you wish, you may use the enclosed release of information form to authorize my request for these records. Please reply within 30 days. If we have no reply within 60 days, we'll assume that you have withdrawn your claim. And so, in the record, Mr. Noah did explain he did not provide the other information because he felt the medical was the most important. He obviously said, I know all the information, where I was at, and what happened. But the way he read the letter was the medical evidence was really what they wanted, and his efforts were to try to get that information within the 60 days.
Counselor, the letter that you read from indicates that a copy of that was sent to his representative, his claims representative.
Correct.
Do you apply any significance to that the claims representative, which I believe was the California Department of Veterans Affairs, didn't stand up and say these numbers aren't right?
Your Honor, I would have to say that somebody who is familiar with the Veterans Administration, even at that time, would have known or should have known that Mr. Noah had 1 year instead of the 60 days. In his testimony, he indicated that he was doing this all on, I mean, he was trying to get the information on his own. Again, he was relying upon the letter. There's no indication that he contacted his representative. In 1981, I'm not sure what the state of the law was regarding how much is put upon having representation as opposed to being having no representation. I know at some point the court has held attorneys to a higher standard if they're representing a veteran versus a service organization. So I guess.
Well, that's my point. I guess you and I would probably agree that if an attorney had received that and did nothing and didn't clarify it, there would be a malpractice.
Well, there'd be a very large malpractice suit if Mr. Noah was entitled to benefits going back that far, because it would have been a clear, it would have been a clear mistake.
A word of caution to service officers.
Yeah, this is being recorded, so perhaps if someone's listening. I guess the final thing I would note, Your Honor, is that in Morris, the courts stated regarding the fact that the veteran was sent a letter saying you need this information, didn't tell him a timeline. The court said, here, the secretary properly discharged his duty by notifying the appellant that he must submit additional evidence in order to get his claim adjudication moving. And so therefore, again, in Morris, the due process was, hey, you've been notified. We don't have to tell you when, we just told you. And if you're coming to the agency, you can't argue ignorance. In this case, Mr. Noh's not arguing ignorance. He's saying, I relied upon this specific deadline, tried the best I could, and then I gave up. And so the final thing is this idea that and I understand it's within the context of the equitable tolling. It's like he didn't do anything after the 60 days, and again, for almost 25 years. Again, our position is that he, you know, we're not trying to say it was his PTSD that caused his abandonment. It was his wife, certainly in her statement, said that he was very angry and he gave up. But I guess, for argument purposes, we would say there's evidence that he was suffering from PTSD, and that would be a logical explanation as to why he was discouraged with trying to get help for that particular claim. So,
of course, there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of that in the record, though.
Excuse me?
No evidence of the fact that PTSD prevented.
Oh, no. There's no evidence that was the reason. It was just sort of his wife's statement that he got so angry and discouraged that they moved back to Alaska on some island where there was very few people, and that's where they lived for a number of years, and so.
Anything further?
Nothing further.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted, and the court will greet counsel.
All rise. In recess. Thanks again for your attention. We'll convene our question and answer session in just a moment.